Ivan Potter is a futurist and publisher of the West Kentucky Journal. Mr. Potter has advised governors of the Commonwealth and presidents of the United States on rural development and intergovernmental relations. Today he's joining us in the studio to talk about a recent article of his published in the Journal that looks at the effects of the recent drought on Mississippi River traffic in terms of hard data. Mr. Potter, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
We've seen quite a bit of rain recently. Has that gotten river traffic moving again?
It is moving slowly. The danger is that the sandbars keep shifting, and when you are pulling, say, 9 barges and a tow, and you're about 300 or 400 feet long, 50 to 70 feet wide, it's hard to maneuver. And so the Corps has been very careful about maintaining that the traffic has to have a clear waterway. The last time it was closed was just south of Memphis, and the sandbars, like overnight, just came up. And so they had for a period of about 2 weeks there. And the water has helped out a lot now. But it's always a danger that it will drop down. This time last year, we had the river was 52 feet over flood stage. Today, it's between 6 and 10 feet below average. And at Columbus, we're still got water, but on down south, it's going to be a problem for a while.
How much damage do you think that this drought has done to the river industry?
That's a good question. In our area, Ingram Barge is probably the good example to go with. It is now one of the largest barge corporations in the world. They just finished acquiring about 600 barges and 40 tow boats. They have a facility at Columbus that they repair from. And they move along a 17-state waterway, which is connected through the Mississippi. If the Mississippi does not flow, that affects everything upstream. So it's crucial. That river has to maneuver because it's the interstate for mid-America. Damage-wise, I can tell you that in lost revenue for West Kentucky, when we did our research, there were 2 million acres that corn, wheat, and soybean lost product from. That equal to about, it was 1 million acres, and it was $2 billion of damage. And that was from 24 counties. Well, if you compare the fact that nationally during the hard peak of the drought, it was 1,487 counties at risk in America. We do not know yet for sure just how much money-wise, but it's going to be in the billions, major, major billions. The danger is, if this continues next year as well.
Right.
If we have a dry winter and it moves into a drier spring, and then instead of the 100-degree heat coming into maybe early May or whatever, it starts to move into April. So this is the third year of our drought season. We've had three. This makes the third year now.
Do you see any way to recovery aside from more rain?
Yes. The rain will come again. But our man's activities are beginning to be questioned. In my research, I found in an obscure scientific journal some mention that part of, they think, the reason why the river levels dropped very fast in the Mississippi was the extreme fracking material situation in North Dakota, that maybe the fracking had taken out a lot of water supply for the headwaters of Mississippi all of a sudden, combined at the right time when the drought hit and the hardest. So you have decreased water supply coming in from the headwaters. You have no rain. I think I quit counting after 142 days of no rain. And all that added, plus you have vast farming activities. When you sink a 10, 12, 15-inch well into the ground, and you're drawing water up at, say, 2,500 gallons a minute for agricultural purposes, this water is a finite supply. And when all these factors start to grab at it, then the river, when it gives it up, it can't produce it again until it rains. So we've got to look at how we as humans are interacting with nature all of a sudden.
It sounds like, forgive the term, but it sounds like it was a perfect storm this year.
It was. It was. And when the weather people pray for hurricanes to come in your area and dump water,
right,
it's not a good situation.
So you think this could signal some kind of permanent change?
Yes. I started to be concerned about 3 years out when in Clinton, Kentucky, a small town. We have businesses, older buildings, are 100 years old, brick. And I noticed that the temperatures in August were edging up, and when it went to 105 degrees for about a week, I thought, well, this is very unusual for this time of year. Mm-hmm. So everyone said, it's just a quirk, it's a part of nature, let it go. Then last year, again in late August, we had what I call a very intense heat storm, and where we had 3 days where the heat index was over 122 degrees. And that one of those days, NBC had reported that Owensboro was the hottest point in North America, 121 degrees that they knew of, hard temperature. I did not know it, but that same day, we had a generator left over from the ice storm days with 5 gallons of gasoline in it. Well, evidently, the heat was so intense, it melted the gasket around the one of the areas holding some of the gas in. And I knew about it because the restaurant next to us came over and said, our customers are getting sick over here on fumes coming from your building. Well, I went back, and sure enough, there was gas pouring out over our storage area with all paper. And someone who does heating and cooling told me they had a similar problem in an attic where their headband had melted one morning. When temperature starts to do that, it's different, okay? And then this year, of course, instead of having a tight, concentrated week of a problem, you have months of over 100-degree heat. So I'm hoping this is a phenomenon that's just one time, but we have now three hard summers in a row. And there's a possibility we might have fourth, fifth, and sixth. I'm worried about drought. I'm worried about our senior citizens who, if you look at their air conditioning systems, they're mostly made and designed for the 1990s temperatures. And if you're running your cooling system at 98 or at full capacity and all you can get is down to 95 degrees from 110, you know, at some point they start to break. Well, in the river counties, Ballard, Carlisle, Hickman, and Fulton, you have a lot of senior citizens who have older systems and very few repair people.
So, if they have any systems at all.
Exactly, or maybe they're using fans. And we now have the specter of if we have a very, very harsh heat storms again, people will die if they don't take care to move to cooling centers. And if our elected officials ignore this, I can almost guarantee there will be tragedy here. We forget that in France, I think about 20 years ago, there was a heat storm, and 35,000 people died in Paris because there was no air conditioning, and they were not used to the heat that came. Chicago had a similar event a few years ago. So weather is turning, and I think we have to learn how to adapt. But it's also going to take leadership.
Well, I was going to ask how this is all affecting us now, but I mean that you painted a very vivid picture. I'd like to turn this to the economic and social impact that this is going to have down the road. And you've also referred to the drought as going so far as to refer to it as a national security issue.
Let's assume that next year that when the farmers are clear cutting the tree lines and the drainage dishes of their farmland to put more crop in as possible.
Right.
We have a situation where wind picks up dust, and then we have drought comes in, and the river doesn't get any water, and it has to close for a period of time, and you can't ship food or fuel upriver. Supplies don't get into the big cities. I wrote a piece. I was not making fun. I was just trying to maybe get a feeling to people who make national security to look at the fact that if you have to convoy fuel and food into your cities, you're going to need troops, and Fort Campbell is sitting here with very trained cadre people who just came out of Afghanistan doing the same thing. So the specter of having a 1,000-truck convoy coming up from New Orleans to Memphis or Chicago or Louisville, it's not that far out of rational thought if you lose your river. You have to go either to rail, which won't be able to handle because our rail is in bad shape. You can't fly it in. It's too expensive. So you bring it in by truck. I mean, when food and fuel became that pricey commodity, then people with guns might want to take it before it gets where it's supposed to be. So we're, as my wife Mary says, we exist as a very thin veneer of civilization on top of Mother Nature. If something goes wrong, we're still not prepared enough here to deal with it quickly.
How is this going to reshape Western Kentucky?
I'm hoping Well, for example, the Sierra Club is probably the first group of people to actually step up, and your people on campus here, Sierra Club members, to look at having a sort of water summit conference in October. Try to define who owns the water, what kind of policies we should have as water. Just call it water falls on your land and it flows in your system. You might not be able to own that water. Other people are coming in to buy up watersheds. The price and access of water, one of the questions is, is it a privilege or is it something that you have to pay for? But I think our local leaders can be trained to ask questions of the water companies who are here. We waste water all the time. We all know how we do it. We as Americans, manifest destiny has always been part of our DNA psyche. We think there's always a better tomorrow. We always go over the hill, and it's always new resources. We reach a point now that hill is nothing else there. Our geography and our space, that's what we got to work with. So we have to adapt now to our resource base. And I think small towns and large cities have to come to grips that we got to work together. This is a shared commodity, West Kentucky.
A little earlier, you referred to dust, and when you were painting that picture of the climate here in Western Kentucky, I could not help but think of Oklahoma in the 1930s.
There are reports coming out now, scientific community, that are making some predictions that as we shift in climate, it's like when you hear people talk about the tracks of hurricanes, they give you models to go by.
Right.
One of the models is showing us becoming like eastern Oklahoma, to the possibility that we have very dry air. And to tell you how this can be shocking, I just had a discussion with some people in St. Louis. It was so dry there that all the moisture was sucked out of the earth to where several homes started to tilt. If you got a $250,000 home and it starts to lean about 20 feet to a direction, and then they find out it's not covered by insurance, it becomes a serious problem for you as an individual. The ground lost its moisture and started to give in. What we have here, because we do price supports, and the farmers knew that 80% of their at risk of planting this year would be taken up by crop insurance. So they went full tilt, from fence post to fence post, ripping out tree lines, creek beds, anything got in their way, and just turned all the land into crops. They fisted it up and basically planted like they did in the 30s. History does not repeat itself, but history will mirror itself. We're almost step-by-step repeating what happened in the 20s and 30s, both internationally and here at home. It won't be exactly the same. We have time to step in and say, stop that policy, let's move somewhere else. If our leaders in Congress, we haven't even passed the Farm Bill yet. We haven't even passed they kicked the budget bill down 6 months. This has become a national issue that everyone is involved with. It's like you don't want to mess with the air or the water. Air and water is neither Republican or Democrat or independent. It's human. We're on a rock speeding through the space, and it's the only rock we got. So we have to get right with this, and that's my hope. It will become so bad that the average citizen will say to their congressman, their representative, get it done, make it work. We have the resources in this country. We just finished fighting two wars at trillions of dollars, and I don't even know what $1 trillion is, except it's a lot. Well, what about rebuilding our bridges and our waterways? And then another hopeful thing for Kentucky, outside of Alaska, we have the largest volume of streams in the country flowing through our state. We have water is part of our heritage. It's who we are in Kentucky. We think of it only as lakes or rivers. But at some point, it's going to be a national security item. And I'll tell you why. There are six major megalopolises. That's a giant cities. If you look at from Washington to Boston, from Chicago over to New York, from Houston, Middle Texas, from New Orleans over to parts of Florida, southern Florida, it's all urban. Atlanta, through the Piedmont areas of the Carolinas, fast tracks are nothing but concrete and urban. If you look at a map, right in the middle of all that, there's this sort of blank spot. And that's where we are, from St. Louis to Cincinnati, down to Knoxville, over to Memphis, back at St. Louis. There are like 20 or 30 rivers that are flowing in that box, primarily feeding into the Cumberland, the Tennessee, the Ohio, and the Mississippi. I call that the Great Rivers Megalopolis. And why is that? Because this is the future of how to build a new kind of community. Every urban area we have in the country feeds off of, somebody has to bring in food, bring in water. It's a resource driven where people soak up resources. We are just the opposite. We create resources. We grow things. We have water. We have land. We could be like the Saudi Arabia. We could be the Saudi Arabia for water in Mid-America. Hmm. But there again, it takes leadership. And it takes a community of people getting together. I think the Chamber of Commerce is beginning to wake up. I know the Sierra Club is working hard to bring in CORE and other people. Once we can break through this level of thinking 20th century, that resources are here to be just waste. 21st century is about not oil anymore. It's about going to be water and food.
Mm. Well, author Robert Kaplan has written an excellent series of articles that he collected in The Coming Anarchy, in which he asserts that wars are not necessarily fought over ideology, or they're fought over resources.
Right.
And do you think that the potential for scarcity of resources is going to cause a problem in the United States?
Yes. Robert did an excellent series in Wired magazine. Mm-hmm. And for anybody out there who's listening, Wired magazine is an excellent source to read. Kaplan has done a lot of work about what happens when the system fails. Mm. The average food supply for a major city is about 7 days. If the trucks don't come in, the Krogers and the Walmarts are left with their shelves. After about the 8th, 9th, 10th day, people get really hungry. Milk and bread goes away and perishables. Then they start thinking about, well, where do I get my food? And they go and clean out those stores. We had a situation back in 2005 when there was a gas shortage in Clinton. Our three gas stations shut down because there's no gas coming in by trucks. I asked a young man who's 19, I said, well, what does it mean to you? And he said to me, I'm packing. If I want gas, I'll go in and get it. And he was serious. He had guns. He would take his gas. Had no qualm about it at all. I'm afraid if in times of crisis, if we're not prepared, we revert to some really basic instincts. Hmm. And Kaplan's right. You got 50 states and 3,000 counties, but we're also tribes. We're southern, we're northern, we're western, and we're in valleys, we're in hollers, and your geography is about, what you're going to walk, a mile or two, and that's your daily life. And by car, you're in a 5 or 10 mile range, and that's where you protect your family.
Mm-hmm.
So best case out of that is maybe we'll go back to small towns, small areas, actually become sustainable. We've got to move to sustain life out of the grid and create new grids. We have had tight. We can do this. Kaplan's theory is that our leadership will fail us and that we will have to do this ourselves.
Hmm.
So I'm hoping he will be wrong in the long run, but in the short run, we have probably a decade before he could be right.
Hmm. That's certainly a very bleak picture. But you spoke of hope.
It's bleak. In that it will hopefully wake people up that things are not just moral issues anymore or politics or economics. It's about how do we deal with the furtherance of the human species on this planet. The Chinese have a problem. They can probably only feed 30% of their people. That's why they're into every area trying to grow food. If the wheat crops in Ukraine and in Brazil and other places in Canada go down, then we're left here with our own wheat supply. We can do this. It's a question of, at every state level, in a small town like Clinton, the city fathers, and I'm a city councilman, so I'm trying to get that message in there too. We can start looking at what can we do to adapt to the situation. And it's a lot. We have resources that we haven't used. We have money that we've been wasting in other areas. And again, I keep on preaching leadership and commitment to fixing it.
Mm.
It's like when your car doesn't work. Bring in mechanics and let's make it happen.
My last question is, most people tend to resist the improvements that are available in power generation technology, for instance, because they are going to they're going to hit them in the pocketbook. The
yes,
rates are going to go up and things like that. How do we overcome that sensibility without the major disaster that forces people to take another look?
Let's say KU decides next week, Kentucky Utilities, that their rate is low, so they're going to increase it by 300%. Or my water company in Clinton came in at a city council meeting about 3 years ago and said, we're not making enough money, so we're going to increase your water rate by 52%. And there's nothing you can do about it. Well, my wife, Mary Potter, led a citizens' revolt, basically. Got 160 people at several meetings, and Public Service Commission came down. We beat them back. They only got 31%. But then this year, they came back for the rest of it. Now, one of the things we could do, there's an attempt now to legalize hemp as a fiber product. Biomass plants in West Kentucky is a natural. Whether it's hemp or silage or some other product, we can grow things here. A biomass plant in every county basically can help get us off of the grid as we know it. We can do sustainability. We can make electricity out of the river. We can put power plants in the river, on top of the river, wind power. We are blessed with all this raw potential for power, but as long as there are special lobbyist interests in Frankfurt and Washington, as long as your congressmen are bought by those special interests, as ours seem to be, as long as Big Coal has a position at the table to dictate who sets at the table, then it's not going to happen because everyone's reacting to profit for this quarter. They're not looking at what's going to happen a year, 5 years, 10 years down the road. I will tell you this. My opinion is that Big Coal is exactly where tobacco was when it got hit with all the lawsuits and problems and the public turned against it. We're getting close to that point when the public wakes up and turns against these legacy interest holders who are there basically as what remained from the robber barons of the early 1900s.
Well, I said in my last question, but this might very well be, is there a way to, because we have an abundance of coal in Kentucky. I mean, yes. Is there a way to use it?
Yes, yes. Friends of mine are telling me that there are ways of you can build energy plants near coal mines. You don't have to rip off mountains. It doesn't matter how dirty the coal is. There's new science available, but it's a cost factor. If you're getting all this profit and you don't have to make any changes, they're not going to do it until they're forced to. But yes, we can use coal in this new age. Again, it's getting people to sit down at the table and agreeing to do it. It's called having a backbone in public service.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. Futurist Ivan Potter is also publisher of the West Kentucky Journal. Mr. Potter, thanks for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.